This is the 3D Pod, your number one source for 3D printing news, analysis, and insight from 3DPrint.com. Now, here are your hosts, Joris Peels and Maxwell Bogue.
Hi, everyone. My name is Joris Peels, and this is another episode of the 3D Pod. And with me, as always, is Maxwell Bogue. How are you doing, Max?
I'm great. How are you doing, Joris?
I'm good. And enjoying life generally and happy with all the exciting stuff going on in 3D printing. So, yeah, in a good place. How about you?
I'm good. Yeah, there does seem to be a lot coming out right at the beginning of this year that's quite exciting and fun. So, yeah. Speaking of which, who are we speaking with today on the 3D Pod?
Well, that's really awesome, actually, because we have François Minec on the 3D Pod today. And he started as a chemical engineer before doing more polymer engineering and stuff. And he was, in a bunch of different polymer businesses as like a general manager, business manager, that kind of thing, product manager. Ended up joining the 3D printing industry in 2015, working for a company called Advanced 3D Materials, which is kind of like a powder bed fusion material supplier, right? There was an independent powder bed fusion material supplier. There weren't a lot of those around. And he worked that a couple of years until it was bought by BASF Ford AM. Right. And then he became the manager of BASF Ford AM later on. And then he moved over to HP, where he was first a global head of strategy. And now he's a global head of the polymer 3D printing business at HP, based in Catalonia. So, yeah, there's lots and lots of stuff we want to ask and talk about with François. So, yeah, pleased to, it's great that you're here, François, today.
Thank you. Thank you for welcoming me on the show. And thanks to the great introduction. I think you got my CV right.
Yeah, that's encouraging.
It's good. I can read LinkedIn. It's a skill. So François, so first off, how did you end up joining the 3D printing industry? Like, how did you end up you were working in polymers generally, and all of a sudden you saw the high price for SLS powders, or and then you were like, oh my god, this is an opportunity? Or what made you join this industry?
It's actually a complete coincidence. Indeed, I was working in the polymer industry. I was a reseller for different kinds of polymers and polymer powders and granules, etc. And then one of my supplier of polymer powder, which we were using for other kind of application, asked me, can you look if this could fit in 3D printing? I heard there's this industry which is starting. And so then we investigated this market at the time. And of course, this powder would never have worked in 3D printing, but it caught my attention. And parallel to that, a friend of mine who had an R&D company for polymers told me, well, we have now a PhD who's developed know-how in developing powders for 3D printing. So, on one side, I had the market know-how, which was there, and then I had the powder development part of it. And that's where I said, okay, let's go for it. Let's create a company.
Okay. And then, of course, we do know that actually I tried to do this for a while as well, that making powder for powder bed fusion is actually super duper difficult, right?
Yeah, that's where actually after starting the company, I realized it was much more difficult than I thought. So I started to look at other businesses for short term, like filament and reselling printers to get some, short term revenue. But on the powder, eventually we got lucky. First thing is, we were reselling some powders from other chemical manufacturers who were trusting in us. So and this was Arkema at the time. So we were working in reselling Arkema powder. And then we got lucky also in our R&D and finally found a polymer which was printable, which is a very hard thing. And that's where things started, really. But it took a lot of time and a lot of R&D investment.
Was this one of those scenarios where if you had known the effort involved to get to just that point, that you might not have necessarily started the company?
I think if I had known before starting the company how hard and how much money I would need to invest to get one powder, I'm not sure I would have done it, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. So ignorance wins again in creating a new company that works. So.
Yeah, but also it was interesting at the time because there was Arkema was the new kid on the block relatively. They had some interesting PA11 formulations and stuff, Rilson, right? Which is very interesting material. And then, Evonik, which essentially I think at the time it was even said that Evonik sold powder, and also just all the powder from 3D Systems was from Evonik, and all the powder from EOS was from Evonik. So it was like you can have your Evonik powder from three different ways. And they had ALM, which was then also owned by the Langer family of EOS, right? And then you had, I think there was a small French company, like Exceltech or something, they made powder. And that was it, essentially. The whole world was very much stratified, very few vendors. And then how did you manage to make it as a smaller firm then? Because then, of course, yeah, the next thing is how to find customers and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, especially at the time was very difficult because the machines are mostly closed, as you know. In the time, there was mostly SLS when I started the company. MGF was just starting, but MGF was also closed. And so it was very difficult to convince customers to get the, you know, to test the material. So it took time. And I eventually went to machine manufacturers and tried to get the powder approved on the machine manufacturer. One of them was HP at the time already, but then realized that if I want to scale the production, I need investment, which are way out of what I could get from my current investment. And, you know, not only investment in manufacturing capabilities, but continuing to develop the powder that it really works well. And that's when I turned to BASF at the time.
Yeah, because this is interesting because people always talk about how the powder cost is high. The similar powders are being used in spray paint type applications and stuff like that, powder coating, and everybody's always talking about the cost is high. And could you explain a little bit, because you're a chemical engineer, a lot of polymer experience, you know, apart from the volumes, and you know, there's a part of greed in there for some people as well, and the grinding, right? So there's a couple of elements that make this powder quite expensive, right?
This is, it's not that you can just take any granule, you know, and grind it and it will work on a 3D printer. So it's like the chance of it working are zero. So there's a lot of know-how, there's a lot of R&D involved. But as you said, I mean, either the powder is grinded and then grinding has a huge cost, or the powder is directly made in a precipitation process, or I will not bore you with the chemical process. But these processes are expensive, and not only expensive in running them, but they are expensive in CapEx. So you need huge CapEx, so capital expenditure, to put this plan there. So I don't think, you know, there's this word that there's greed in between, and there's no greed. It's just this is cost a lot of money, and you know, everybody's in this game to make money. So you cannot blame the chemical companies for overpricing the product, where really we are asking them to develop the product and to make all these investments to make the product.
Yeah, but do you think it's in a confidence thing? Because like TVs is a similar investment. That's even crazier, right? I mean, my favorite example is at one point Sony was losing $50 every television they sold, right? But still, televisions get made, and they get made cheaply, and that's again super high cost CapEx. You have to fill your whole production volume kind of business. Is it just that they don't have the long term confidence, or is it they don't have the volume, or how can we help them then make this cheaper? Because I'm always thinking maybe it's like EasyJet, right? If we make the flights $50, maybe we fill the whole airplane, and then maybe it becomes cheaper, across the entire business.
I mean, you're partly right. It's a question of scale. If the industry was 10 times bigger and would consume 10 times more powder, the powder would be definitely cheaper. I mean, I don't want to give some order of magnitude, but at least, you know, 30 to 50% cheaper, I think it would go there. So it's a chicken and egg, you know. So who's going to do the first step? So that's where we are today. But it's certainly a question of scale.
And then what was your time like in BASF? Because you all of a sudden you went from, you know, polymer companies to your own thing, like your own boss, and all of a sudden you're in this giant corporation, this BASF, this Ludwigshafen thing, which is like, I know, it's like the biggest thing I've ever seen. it's like you know, and all of a sudden this company around it, like that must have been a very different experience for you, right?
I mean, I must say BASF is an impressive company, and especially if you go in Ludwigshafen, which is one of the biggest, if not the biggest chemical site in the world, where about 30,000 employees work. You have a train line going in there, which is quite impressive. But BASF did it in a very clever way. The BASF 3D printing, the name of the company was BASF 3D printing, and the brand is Forward AM. Was set up separately, so we were not in Ludwigshafen, we're in Heidelberg, which is a bit separate, and was also set up as a subsidiary, so not involved in the normal corporate. It was really a daughter company managed completely independently.
So you guys were basically allowed to operate independently.
Yes, exactly. I mean, we were having, you know, the regular reporting and controlling that you expect from such a company, but not needing to follow all the systems and the heaviness that is required for running such a big company. I mean, all the IT systems are quite complex, which is normal. That's what, you know, in such
a big company. No, but you were spared the bureaucracy, exactly. Essentially. Yeah. So, to allow you to then more freely create and realize the end goal. That's cool. It's a good strategy of them.
Yeah, I think it was very clever, and it allowed and still allows BSF for them to grow fast and to be agile. I think I like the strategy that we set up when I was there. You know, we were having the powder, obviously, which I brought partially, but also doing resins, so UV resins and filaments. But also then had the service bureau.
And was that different for you to, like, because, you know, essentially what BASF did, they bought volume. They bought a whole bunch of companies, I think, like six or seven, I think, in total.
So, not six, seven, but several companies were purchased. One is a filament company, which was acquired, and then my company. And finally, we acquired also Sculteo Service Bureau. And the idea was to build full portfolio of raw materials, of high quality raw materials for the industry, but also being independent from any machine manufacturer. And the idea of having a service bureau was to accelerate testing and adoption of the different materials. Having our own service bureau was allowing us to get much faster feedback on new materials.
And do you think that because, like, we are talking now, like, I think BASF had a really good strategy at the time. I liked, as part of the strategy, I liked the BASF one better. I liked the BASF one and also DSM, where DSM was really application focused and BASF was kind of like learning and feeding back into materials focused. Do you think that these companies, like, you know, that we saw, like, before, the chemical companies were really interested. Now they seem much more aloof, right? Much less interested. Did we just never get the volume that they needed for that to be really relevant for a company as large as BASF? Or was it always going to be like a side gig for them? Or do you think we just need more time?
Well, it's true that when you look 5 years ago or even 10 years ago, there was always this say that, you know, the industry will accelerate, there will be this hockey stick, and there will be so much volumes. The reality is the volumes that we move today are in general very small compared to the chemical industry or compared to the polymer industry. It's less than 1%, and I think even less than 0.2% of the whole polymer consumption. So it's still small, it's growing, you know, but even if you grow double digit from such a small scale, it's not really relevant. So I don't know if the companies will stay so much involved. This is maybe important for them in this industry, but doing the formulations that they do, I'm not sure it will stay like this. DSM already divested and sold their business to Stratasys. Let's see what will happen with BASF.
But the business that is there is real. So what I do like is that there's a kind of a reset in the industry where expectations are more real. It's more difficult for us to get money, but the business that we're doing is actually a real business, you know?
Yeah, and I totally agree with this. And I was discussing with some colleagues from the industry and saying, what is our expectation and what's the next big thing? And I think, like one of the colleagues was saying, the next big thing is we should start to be boring, meaning 3D printing should become, you know, and is to become a normal manufacturing process as other processes, and that's how it will scale.
Okay, and then
boring.
And let's just talk about materials. Like, let's talk specifically about powder-bed fusion materials. I mean, given your experience, what do we need to do? Is it just a question of, you know, couldn't we just all get together and make a big order at BASF to make it really cheap for everyone? Or do we need to develop more materials or more specific materials? What do you think needs to happen to make materials, like, you know, the material part of the equation better?
I mean, today, as you know, in powder bed, like 90 or between 80 and 90% of the total market is PA12. And for a simple reason is that the technology was developed around PA12. Developing other materials for this technology is quite hard. There's a question of processing window, which is quite complex to achieve. There's PA11, which represent about less than 10% of the consumption, but is even more expensive. So I think at the end, what the industry needs is scale on one side, simply. I mean, and it's going to be a chicken and egg. So we need a lower price to get the scale, but we need the scale to get the lower price. So both sides, the machine manufacturers and the users and the chemical manufacturers, need to work together on that. And I think it's already in the move. I mean, I know. Thing, but I know these are conversation we're having. Plus, obviously, it needs a bit of competition because today there was only one PA12 manufacturer, which was Evonik. Now Arkema is getting more and more active in this. As you know, we introduced on the HP platform the Arkema powder, which is a competitive powder. So let's see how this develops.
Okay. And also, do you think, because like the issue we've always had, I think, from industry is always we've been talking to industries and they say, well, if you could make my polycarbonate, right, then, and this is especially a problem on material extrusion, where people always be like, well, you know, if we could use the same polycarbonate we've always been using, we'll be happy. So we get in this trap where we keep making more and more and more materials, right? And maybe we never get that volume. Or do you think that maybe in material extrusion, for example, that making those lots and lots of materials is actually a key to unlocking all these different new clients and new applications?
I think the beauty of additive manufacturing is you can design, you know, for applications, and one material can cover many more spectrum thanks to the easiness of design. So I don't think we need, you know, like in the polymer industry, there's hundreds of thousands of materials because each there's some polymers and then these polymers are compounded. So like the number of formulations of polymers out there are hundreds of thousands. When I was running a polymer distribution company, we had more than 5,000 references in stock. So just to give you, and this was a medium-sized company. So I think we don't need so many references, but there are some things which are key. You know, for example, having some flame retardant powder which has a reasonable price to unlock application, that's key. So bringing some additional value makes sense, but we don't need so many.
Okay, and then how do you deal with like this? Another thing that we've always kind of got trapped in, and it literally happened yesterday again, when somebody asked about like how do we equal the performance of injection molded parts? Should we even be asking that question, or should we just spend a lot of time doing that, or should we just say no? We need to be making different parts, not the injection molded parts. You know, it's like asking somebody like, you know, can we have the same compressive strength as brick walls? No, we're making polymers. Is it just a different game we're playing, or?
Yeah, I think that's the whole reason why, you know, additive manufacturing, even if it's, you know, growing to double digit, there's no hockey stick, because there's a whole industry to educate on design for additive manufacturing. If we have a customer coming to us and say, I have this part, it's designed. However, I would like to know if I could print it in 3D. Then it's too late, you know. We tell most of the time the answer is, yeah, we can print it in 3D, and most probably it will fail and it will be too expensive. But if you're happy that we look at the whole process and redesign the part, then it makes sense. So that's where the difficulty is. So we're not here to replace injection molding, and this discussion doesn't really make sense to me.
So how do we get this business to grow then? What's your advice? What should we be doing to make this business, from 1% to 10% of the traditional manufacturing?
So, I mean, there's different axes. Obviously, one is what I just said, design for additive manufacturing. And I recall a customer visit I was doing a few weeks ago where they started doing 3D printing 5 years ago. And now there are 200 engineers, and now all the 200 engineers finally are trained. And on the next model of vehicle that they are bringing, there's no longer 10 parts printed, but there's going to be 100 parts printing. So this step by step will increase. But obviously, the other thing is cost per part, because at the end of the day, this is what's driving adoption. As long as we will have such high cost per part, we will not scale. So that's why we are working. You know, that's my number one goal, is to continue decreasing the cost per part.
So how do we do this? Like, the material is one equation. Like, and then the other thing is, like, well, now you're at HP, right? We kind of told about that. We'll talk about HP later. But, you know, the obvious thing is we could make a better software for the printer to, you know, eke out some more things. We could get lots of post-processing equipment. Or you can make much bigger machines. So what are you thinking about there to really get that cost per part down?
Well, there's many axes to do that. Of course, one is material and working with the suppliers. But the other one is, for example, especially in powder bed, to work on refresh rates. As you know, the product that we are bringing on have each time better refresh rate. The latest one, the Arkema PA12, has a refresh rate of about 10 to 15%. So meaning we don't throw away powders anymore, which is also good for sustainability. But then is to increase productivity and increase machine utilization. There's a lot of things that we are working on this.
When we're calculating a cost of a part, I mean, what percentage currently do you estimate the material is? Is it the majority of the overall costs during the calculations, or is it the post-processing and the labor and all of that that also goes along hand in hand?
It depends of the application and the size of the part, etc. But as a general rule, I would say the material is about, it's anywhere between 30 and 50% of the cost. And then the rest is shared between the printer and the post-processing. So material has a significant part, but the amortization of the printer and maintenance, etc., is another significant part. And that's why if you increase the productivity on the same printer, then you gain a lot of cost per part. And that's what we're working on a lot. So if you have seen, we talk about HP maybe later, but there's a lot of automation solutions to get the printer running day and night, which we are bringing on.
Okay. I like the day and night operation. That's a lot of, you know, we were like kind of a 9-to-5 industry for a while. This is also a bit weird, but so the day and night operation, operating continuously, pushing out builds, that all sounds like really very exciting to me in terms of, you know, making that machine cost really, really, really quite low. Is there more we could be doing in like, you know, in the just making the business case better, or do you think or we could just give a free 3D printing university to everyone? You know what I mean? Is there any kind of like world changing stuff we could be doing as vendors, or do you see that's or an industry?
What I think is working is to select really industries which are already adopting and really where 3D printing makes sense, and doubling down on there and really spending the time to develop the full solution for this industry. I mean, I just give you an example, orthotics and prosthetics, which is, as you know, big market for 3D printing already. We've only scratched the surface of it. If you look at it, I think less than 5% of the OMPs in the world are 3D printed. So doubling down on that, and also not coming like with just a printer and say, guys, you want to do OMP, here's a printer. Good luck. We can install it and you run it and it's fine. All these companies, they need a software solution. They need a post-processing solution. So that's where we need to work more. And that's what we're doing in HP as an industry, is doubling down where we have really a competitive advantage.
Okay. Because yeah, of course, we moved. You moved then from BASF to HP, where you now lead the polymer business, where you guys have been successful in becoming a player in the polymer business. What do you think is, first off, what do you think has been HP's like success so far? What has made your success so far? And what do you think is the challenge for you guys going forward?
I mean, I must say, when I was at BASF side, when I looked at HP, when I saw them coming in the industry in 2016, I think was the official start, I was like, okay, it's going to take time for them to penetrate the market. You know, it's a complex market, they don't know. And I must say, I was impressed at the time how fast HP penetrated the market, how fast HP became a leader. And I think what they did very well is really bringing a technology which is reliable and which brings down the cost per part compared to what was the standard at the time, and which really is a production tool, no longer a prototype tool, but really a production tool. And that's where HP has done a very great job.
We somehow always forget that, like, depending on how you, okay, costing is really important and also really weird for 3D printing, like you mentioned before, like the part size and all sorts of other different things. But in some cases, we're talking that the MJF is 30 to 40% cheaper than alternatives, right? For a lot of like high yield stuff. So that, yeah, I think that the idea that they you know, they really made an effort to be cheaper, I think was a really, really big, I agree with you. That's a really big thing, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, indeed. And as I was saying, I think this continues to be the target to make it cheaper. Because if you look at it, the injection molding market or the CNC market, plastic part manufacturing market is made of small series, medium-sized series, large series. And as you go to bigger and bigger series, the volumes involved are much bigger. So it's actually an exponential curve. We did the studies together with AM Power, looking at how would the market grow with decreasing TCO, and it's actually exponential. So that's what drives me at HP today, is to get there.
Okay, that sounds really good. But and do you think then? What do you think would be the biggest challenges then of HP? What do you think is the things that are keeping you from growing, or what do you think you need to overcome then?
I know we'll not enter in all the secrets on what we're working, but some of the challenges are actually based on the powder, because the reality is our printer is so fast today that we are limited not by the speed of the printer, but the speed at which the powder melts. That's the reality today. So it's some challenge that we are tackling together with our suppliers to continue working on that. That's one of the challenge. The other challenges are mostly about automation and continue to automate so that the printer runs 24/7.
And are you envisioning you're going to have to create a new powder essentially, or have even a new polymer in order to solve the problem? Or do you think that it's solvable with the existing materials that are available on the market?
We are,
or
not
can you not comment on that?
I'm just going to say we're not a chemical company, so it's not
fair.
I've tried myself in the past to develop a powder. I know what it takes.
You know how much it takes.
So it's like, but yes, things need to improve there. That's for sure. That's one axis of development. But the reality, in order to scale, I mean, yes, TCO is important. But also repeatability, reliability of printers, and that's on a subject on which we've worked a lot in the last year. You know, we launched this new printer, and the concept of this new printer is that it's so each user can calibrate it by himself, and then if you buy a fleet of 20 printers, then you can have them fully calibrated between themselves, and then ensure that you print a print job on one printer, on the other, the parts will come out exactly the same with the same reliability. So that's really something important also for scaling.
And then, okay, I think that sounds really, really a lot like very sensible. But then you mentioned DFAM, for example, right? Do you think we should take away DFAM so we can invest lots and lots of money in making automated AI-powered software or something, or we can make that happen, or we could train a lot of people, Or we could just make solutions for specific applications like OMP. Or do you think you have to do all those things to grow the market?
I think we have to do a bit of everything. On DFAM, you know, there's the word artificial intelligence is coming more and more. And I think we're not that far that we can just say, draw me a 3D print STL file for earbuds, and it will automatically do it. So we're not that far. So that will really accelerate DFAM, I think. Yeah, that's just one of the challenges.
Okay, and how about the applications? I mean, are there other applications that you're really excited about besides OMP?
Yes, obviously, there's many applications on which we're working. At the moment, where I'm really excited is to see some automotive manufacturers starting to adopt more and more, no longer just for prototype and jigs and fixtures, obviously. Even if, to be honest, the potential of jigs and fixtures is still big for in the automotive industry, and in 3D printed jigs and fixtures. But now we're going to functional prototypes, so cars which actually drive with 3D printed parts, which then leads to the fact that these parts are approved as functional prototype, but also for the final use. So if a mold comes late or there's a problem in the manufacturing of the mold, the parts which were designed for the functional prototype in 3D printing can jump in, say, and you can bridge production this way. And we had an example recently with General Motors, who had a mold which was missing, and several thousands of cars which were standing on a parking place. And we, our service bureau jumped in, produced all the parts, and which allowed to sell the cars. You can imagine it was just a small part, but 3D printed helped this way. So I think this adoption is coming, and not only for bridge production, but we see, and you have all seen the announcement of the Celestiq car from GM, which has more than 100 3D printed parts. I don't exactly remember the number. I think it's 120. And I'm proud that several of them are MGF printed.
And then, of course, you guys also have like some lower competition. There's some Chinese players in powder bed fusion. There's some desktop type players in powder bed fusion. Are you going to, you know, play in the low end space there, or do you think that larger machine, more productive, that's the way you guys will go towards like your future?
Never say never, but really our strategy is industrialization, and we are really laser focused on industrialization and bringing industrial tools. I welcome all competition, and the low ends actually play a part in this adoption. If you have many OEMs where they have a small 3D printing lab and investigate on these low-end printers, and it's great because then once they scale, they will need some industrial solution like ours. So welcoming the competition, and it's also good to challenge our teams to get better.
And on a personal level, what do you hope to achieve in your time at HP? What do you hope? What is there like a real target, or you should like a general goal you want to work towards with your team?
I just mentioned this relation between the size of the market and the cost per part. So my goal is really to reach this multiplication of the market by 10 by reaching this lower cost per part. So that's, I'm laser focused on that. All the, you know, the teams are focused on that. So that's what keeps me awake and very confident I can reach it.
Okay, this is very hopeful that is your goal, and I think it'd be really, really very exciting if we get anywhere near that, and I think it'd be really, really good for everyone. So thanks for being on the show today, Francois.
Thank you, Royce. Thank you, Max.
And thank you for being here, Max.
Oh, thank you, Charles.
And thank you for listening. This is another episode of the 3D Pod. Have a great day.
You've been listening to the 3D Pod. For more information on what you just heard or to subscribe, visit www.3dprint.com or follow us at 3dprint_com.